This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Sports play an important part in the high school experience. 3 out of 4 American families with school-age children have at least one child playing in organized sports. So we're talking about 45 million kids. Mark Dreibelbiss is the North Carolina High School Athletic Association's Associate Commissioner. He's been involved with school athletics his entire life as an athlete, a coach, a referee, and as athletic director for Appalachian State University. On today's program, we continue our series of Monday Meets with a look at the life and the work of Mark Dreibelbiss. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your childhood growing up. You were busy, active in sports as a kid?
Relative. You know, I did all the Little League baseball and basketball. Didn't have much of a football body, so played peewee, and then that was about it. Figured that out really quickly. But absolutely, you know, if there was a not only in organized sports, but, you know, after school, if there was a ball hanging around, we were using it in some shape, form, or fashion.
You grew up in Charlotte, right?
I did, yes, sir.
And your father played an important part in shaping your ideas about sports, right?
I grew up in a very education-based family. My father was a coach, and then he was a principal, and my mother was a secretary at a school, and then went and worked for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system.
You couldn't get away with anything.
My dad was my principal for 7 straight years. It was really bad.
Oh, they got
okay?
me along.
It was really bad. Okay, and you know, it's funny that. You grow up a gym rat, and you're just hanging around, and you're watching your father teach and coach and be a role model to students. And little did I know that 50-some years later, those are the basic tenets that I would be representing in my career. Pretty neat.
Well, how was he as a coach? What did you learn from watching him?
Dad, very, very to the point, disciplinarian, I don't want to say strict, but very much set the bar of expectations. But when that role was over with, he was able to be a father to his student athletes, show a funny side, show a compassionate side, show a caring side. So that, you know, when we're doing the X's and O's and we're practicing or in game situations where there's some emotion involved and, you know, we're pretty tense and pretty terse and trying to get our message. But afterwards, we, you know, hey, that was the game part of it. Now this is the life part of it. And I think that's one of the things that I've learned or took from him more than anything is to have that caring, compassionate side outside of what you're doing.
It's a difficult thing in coaching, it seems to me, and when you know, you grow up watching the good ones and the ones you didn't think were so good. The key, it seems for me, and I wonder how you feel about this, is look, it's a game, so it's got to be structured, right? And there's a winner and a loser, so we have to structure ourselves around the winning and the losing, and then these expectations. So it'll really be fun. It's got to be structured, and we have to know how to play. And yet it's not about winning and losing. And it's that art, that paradox of setting a goal for any kind of standard athletic competition and still being able to have fun seems to me the art of coaching.
It is, and I do a lot of student leadership workshops, and I tell them, if your goal is go undefeated, win the conference, win the states, I said, those aren't goals. Those are dreams. What your goals need to be is become a better student, become a better athlete, become a better teammate, and thus you'll become a better person. And that's really what education-based athletics is all about in its truest sense. Now, sometimes we do get lost in those expectations of winning, and that's when we allow some things to come into our games or games that maybe aren't as positive as the whole outcome should be.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that as this conversation progresses, but I want to find out a little bit more about you as well. After high school, college athletics in the picture for you?
Tried out at Appalachian State University for baseball, and you learn very quickly that if you're a pretty good high school player, that might not necessarily carry over to be a pretty good collegiate player. And I always tell people that you got to know how good you are, but you also have to know how good you are not. And I was able to find that out pretty quickly. So I tried out, but it was one of the best things for me because athletics had been such an important part of my life that I had to find some other things to do. You know, became involved in student government, became very involved in residence hall, dormitory responsibilities, became an RA, a residence advisor, got involved in one of my suite mates was a performing arts major. I didn't know anything about the performing arts, but he asked me to go to play practice one day. And so I did. And I sat there in the theater and I was agape at how talented all these people were. And this guy that I lived with and, you know, just had collegial conversations with, I saw him have a talent and put that on display on stage, and never got into that, but helped build some sets for them because it could support him and his responsibilities. And so got very involved in intramural activities, and I think it helped shape me to be able to be a more well-rounded person. I give a lot of presentations across the state, helped me to get out in front of people and not be in such a closed, you know, team setting, but more learning about different people and different experiences. Very beneficial.
When did you start coaching?
As soon as I graduated. When I graduated in 1977, I went and had a neat experience in Watauga County. Their schools don't have a middle school structure. They are kindergarten through eighth grade. And I was Coach D, and so you would coach the seventh and eighth graders, and I helped out at the high school a little bit. But then you also got to work with the elementary students, and that wasn't athletic based. That was true physical education training and activity based. So it was a pretty good balance.
I guess that's also key to all of this, is understanding where young people are in their physical development to know what to demand of them and when to back off a little. Huh?
It really was, and the other thing is, we had an exceptional children's unit that was tied in with the school. So I got to I learned a lot in teaching and life with my teaching colleagues that were in the special needs area, and it was an area that opened my eyes. And you see the benefits of helping others who might not be as able as some other folks were. And so that helped me too in having a more well-rounded understanding of there's a lot of things out there in life and a lot of different ways we can make a difference.
What were some of the challenges for you when you began coaching?
Learning how to coach. Thinking that I got to go undefeated. Thinking that I'm the guy in charge, that every decision I make is going to move me to the next level. And we talk a lot with our young coaches, don't get misplaced. And I learned that just from lack of experience, that you're not going to be Roy Williams and Mike Krzyzewski right out of the box. And
no, it takes two or three years.
And don't coach that way. you have to understand the level of your athlete, and you better structure your practices and your training sessions and make sure that your skill set and what you're trying to teach matches the skill set of the participants. And if they aren't on par, if your skill set that you're trying to implement is above the talent or the ability set, it's going to be unsuccessful. And you learn that just through trial and error. And you know, after a while, you figure it out a little bit.
Well, that really speaks to understanding the group that you're working with and paying a lot of attention. And again, not coming in with your PowerPoint or with your, you know, with your chalkboard presentation, but looking at, as you say, who have I got here? What are they ready to do? What about leadership? Because that I think is another big question, probably tough for a learning coach. Like, you're the boss, you're the coach, you know it all, and then you got to teach these kids. When did you first realize there's a lot of leadership among those kids?
When I made a mistake with one of my student athletes, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. They went on to the high school, and they were so excited about making the freshman team. And they came in at halftime of one of my games, and we were down about 3 points and weren't playing well. And they shared that excitement with me, and I didn't share it back. And that mother was kind enough to call me at home and let me know that I hadn't done a very good job of leadership, and she was 100% right. And, you know, you have to learn through your mistakes.
Yeah.
And that was one of those things about the perspective of what we're trying to do in education-based athletics and the real value of it. And as I said, I was misplaced. And but it always puts a smile on my face because I still see that family when I go back to Boone. And it's just one of those great learning experiences that helps you get better.
We have to be willing to admit your mistakes, which is another hard thing to do, especially when you've got kids in your charge. You think, I've got to be the expert here. And again, letting go sometimes and knowing there's somebody in that clubhouse or that locker room who just might be able to inspire the kids a little bit. And if you can all work together, you don't have to be the big boss every minute. Did that take you time to get to that? Because, again, I think that can be a hard thing to do your first day on the job when so much responsibility, you feel it so deeply.
That's the value. And when I talk to coaches, I say, would you rather have talent or chemistry? And 100 out of 100, they all say chemistry. And so leadership is something that, you know, there are different people that say it's innate or it can be a learned skill. It is something that can be developed. Sometimes you have those that are natural leaders, and you probably don't have to work as hard on that. But sometimes that's something that, as opposed to execution and performance on a field or a court, that may need to be secondary as to forming your leadership module of your team.
Well, that mom helped you out a little bit by suggesting that you missed an opportunity. Your dad also followed you into your coaching career and even recorded a little bit of your activity, which apparently was a learning experience for you as well.
Well, and I always tell people, you better take the opportunity to laugh at yourself, or you're missing an opportunity that everyone else is taking. And this is one of those. My father came and watched me coach because I asked him to. I had such respect for him, and he was very complimentary the first game. Second game, he brought a video camera, and the old style, the big one, and he videotaped me. And he said, I want you to watch this. And then he said, son, you need to change your approach and your application, or you're not going to last long in life in this profession. And it was great that I watched myself. I was upset at a traveling call that I thought was missed. And I think three possessions later, I'm still on the referee about that traveling call, and I missed three opportunities to instruct. And that's what coaching is. It's instruction. That was a great learning curve for me. And I laugh at this. It was probably one of the reasons that I figured out, you know, this coaching gig might not be my deal. I think I'm going to go into officiating. At that time, our teachers sometimes were our best officials, but it's very difficult now to be in education and have the time with all the committees and the ABCs and the like to do that. But I actually started my high school officiating career while I was a school teacher. And that's beneficial for us because when our officials are in school-based athletics, they understand, and it gives you an appreciation of what all goes into it. But yes, my father was he was my evaluator and observer initially.
I like the fact that he watches the first game, kind of smiles and says, "Nice job, son." Then says, "Nah, he's not going to believe me until I tape this. I'm not going to say a word until I bring the video cable." What do you think it was he saw? Was it the fact that you were, because the lesson you drew from that was you missed some while you were still three plays back, you missed some opportunities to coach. Was that what he was looking at, or just the fact that you were out of control? I mean, what was he trying to show you?
I've always been a very driven person, always been goal-oriented objective setting and trying to meet those things. Probably put that in place too much, mm-hmm. to the extreme. And again, in terms of what you're trying to accomplish, I was looking for perfection. And, you know, that was an unfair expectation, mm-hmm. to my team and teams, because we're not going to be perfect in what we do. But, I heard one coach one time say, if I do a great job in practice, they don't need me as much during the games. And I really wish I had known that right before I started my coaching career.
Well, look, your team might never be perfect, but the officials, they can be perfect, can't they? You did leave coaching. You talked about recognizing maybe this wasn't your field. But before you got into the business of refereeing, you took a position at App State as a fundraiser. What was that like?
I was hired as the assistant alumni director and the annual fund director. So I had fundraising experiences or responsibilities. And then, of course, you know, in alumni affairs, you're out and you're hosting and putting on events and doing the like. Great opportunity. Got to travel the state. Got to meet a lot of Mountaineers, Appalachian alums, who all had the same passion for, you know, our institution, black and gold, and not only in athletics, but, you know, we're raising money for the liberal arts, the cultural arts, the sciences, and faculty development and travel. So it was it was a great experience base for me in terms of a wide range of opportunities.
Then you went on to become athletic director.
Associate athletic
director. How does that prepare you? Does the fundraising part of it prepare you for a job in that office?
Yes, I talked to people a lot who wanted to get into intercollegiate administration, and I said you got to start at the ground floor, get a grassroots opportunity, an understanding of season tickets, seating options, what it takes to run a venue, what it takes to prep, TV and radio, trying to pulse everything, learning about budgeting and travel and scholarship and NCAA rules. It's a long process to be able to handle all of those. And I tell people, if you get an insurance degree, you can be hired as an insurance agent. But to have an athletics administrative degree, you're probably not going to be an assistant or associate AD right off the bat. You've got to get in there and learn the business.
It seems obvious that fundraising is an important part of that job, and yet some people say that's the problem, is that college athletics is so tied to fundraising and money that it's lost a lot of its purity.
In some shapes, I would agree with that. It's like anything, though. If you do the right thing for the right reasons in the right way, then you're gonna get the achievement that is desired. Unfortunately,
I'm going to interrupt you there. Is that up to you? Because it seems like there's so much pressure on the institution to find somebody who the right way means as much money as I can.
And I cannot argue with that, because it is a keep up with the Joneses. You're dealing with recruiting 16, 17, and 18-year-olds who are very impressionable, and it may come down to your locker room is nicer than their locker room, or, where I play or how we travel or where we stay, a lot of the ancillary things. And so it's very competitive in that arena, and a lot of times that's a dollars and cents financial issue. So in order to attract the students and the athletes that you want, you've got to be financially sound.
And again, you talked about some of the deeper virtues and values of learning athletics in terms of team play, sportsmanship, and all the ways we want to round individuals who play sports. And yet, the people who are competing at that level, the people who are competing for scholarships, might have come to sports or have been shaped and molded in their sports understanding in a very different view. They just want to win and get the scholarship, right?
And we have more specialization now in our youth sports, understandably so, because it is a competitive market for scholarship dollars. But there's also a safety and welfare issue that's concerned, because they're starting to become data now that For instance, if you're a volleyball athlete and you are specializing in volleyball all year long as opposed to playing volleyball, basketball, and softball, your likelihood for injury, the percentage increases exponentially. Mm-hmm. And obviously data is a good source for things. And again, it's balance. But we have to remember that these are students. We call them student athletes, but we got to remember they're students. And I use myself, and back to what we talked about earlier, my life experiences and college experiences were benefited from the fact that I wasn't in athletics. I was able to become more well-rounded. And I talk a lot about that. It's important, and athletics and education-based athletics has so much value orientation that can be positive, but it's not the only thing in life.
But is it practical for somebody who's aiming for a scholarship not to specialize, knowing that all their competition is doing it day and night, year round?
Yes. One of our athletes of the year in North Carolina and has already signed or made a commitment. He can't sign yet, but is a dual sport athlete. Mm. There are a lot of them. And what's really fun is to watch the student athletes who might play softball and run track at the same time. Or you always have a lot of the soccer people who kick extra points during football season. But you have a lot of athletes that we cross over seasons. So, we're still playing football in the playoffs, and the basketball coach wants them off the football team so they can start basketball, but they're winning. So, you find a positive balance.
My guest today, North Carolina High School Athletic Association's Associate Commissioner, Mark Dreibelbiss. Just ahead, we're going to talk with Mark about being an official and a little bit more about college athletics as our conversation on today's Monday Meet continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, continuing our series of Monday Meets with North Carolina High School Association's Associate Commissioner, Mark Dreibelbiss. Mark was the National Federation of State High School Associations 2014 Coach Educator of the Year. and has been working to make all high school sports in North Carolina safer. You joined the North Carolina High School Athletic Association in 2005. Talk about that decision to leave the collegiate level and join that group.
That was difficult. I had lived in Boone for 31 years. Obviously was very tied into the community with, you know, not only the fundraising, but then as a associate athletics director in terms of, well, still fundraising, getting sponsorships and dealing with season ticket holders. You almost know everybody, it seems like. And it was fun and really enjoyed that community. But I had the opportunity to come down to the NCHSAA, and at that point, officiating had become a big part of my life, and to have the offer to head up the officiating program statewide was an ominous challenge, to say the least. Yeah. But one, I said, if I'm going to make a move, at that time in my career, I had been with the state for 28 years, and it was just a good time. If I was going to make the move, I needed to make it then, and boy, what a great opportunity it has been.
Had you done much officiating before then?
Yes. I was very active in high school football. I was not a collegiate football official. Obviously, those Saturdays it had a lot to do with being there at App or on the road. But I was a high school and NCAA basketball official for 25-plus years, and I umpired high school and college baseball also for 6-7 years. Did more high school than I did college, but so I did as many sports as I could.
That's a lonely job, isn't it? Officiating.
Well, it's fun but it's a self gratifying.
It's gotta be, because
if you're hanging around for attaboys, you're gonna be pretty miserable. But the thing about officials is it's like coaches. The good ones have to have a little bit of self-confidence. Yeah. And a little bit of that ego edge, because you're going to get questioned a lot. Whether you're coaching, you get a lot of help from the sidelines, and if you're officiating, you get a lot of help from the sidelines. And you have to be able to block that out, and the way to block that out is to be prepared, to be trained, to be competent, and to execute to the best of your ability and feel good about that execution, because you know when you miss one, mm-hmm. or you know when you're unsure about one. And that's where that confidence has got to take you, because you can't let one iffy call. If you're worried about that, you're going to make another one. You got to let it go, and you got to get the next one right.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, how do you do that? You call and you say, oh, I blew it. And now the game is, it's basketball. It didn't stop for you.
Well, the fun part about basketball is you get an instant opportunity to correct that mistake just on one end of the floor or the same end of the floors.
Wait, are you talking about make goods? Do you do make goods?
There is no such thing as a makeup call, okay? And my colleagues still quit. I have said that from day one that I've been officiating.
All right.
But I've also said that there are no such thing as bad calls. Some are just better than others, Frank, okay? Some are just better than others.
So do you guys all get around and say, you know, hey, man, that charge in the third period, that was great, man. Beautiful. That was a great call.
Absolutely. It's funny that you can, you know, on a Friday night in high school basketball or football or whatever sport it is, the officials or the umpires will all get together at an eating establishment and they'll talk. And if you're not in the industry, it'll drive you a little bit crazy, because they'll go, hey, remember at the 3:32 mark of this third quarter, and we had that, what, did you think it was basket interference? And people go, how can you be that specific? But you're so into it and you're so ingrained to it. So, yes, there's a lot of self-critique, but there's also a lot of outside observation and evaluation, mainly from your partners if you're working with a more experienced official who can help you out. The teaching and training aspect, and that's one of the things that probably brought me down to the High School Athletic Association. I was a clinic leader and a teacher and a trainer. I traveled around just because I wanted to help other officials get better, as people had helped me in my career. And because of that, I became a little bit known, you know, across the state in terms of being involved. And so, again, I think it led for the opportunity. Do you want to be the statewide teacher and trainer?
What kind of training do officials at the high school level go through these days?
Great question. Preseason, we are required to go to a minimum of 6 preseason clinics, and most of those are an hour and a half or 2 hours in length. We're required to do a minimum of 3 scrimmages for free. We're required to go to a local association meeting. We're required to go to an annual state rules clinic. Usually I'm given those in football or basketball, or some of our other trainers are. And they have to take a National Federation exam, 100-question proficiency, annually. And all of those are without pay, a lot of time away from home, and you haven't even caught a single game yet. Mm-hmm. Plus, you got to buy your uniforms and stuff. It's a lot of dedication to be an officiate.
What about after the fact? Are the games taped? Do you sit in the tape room afterwards and watch? Do you go over the game?
A lot of our schools have a videotaping program, and we've gotten them, our coaches, to share that. And what they'll do is they'll share to our game assigners. We call them regional supervisors. And say in football, they'll send that Friday night game, and by Saturday, that regional supervisor can send that game to all five officials, and they can watch the game. We're a leader in that nationally. I'm very proud of that. And our video is the greatest teacher that you can have. It's why our teams look at it. Why shouldn't our officials be looking at it? We do a lot of video review just on if plays are sent to our office. A coach may think that, hey, Mark, take a look at this. We take that. We'll send it. We'll clip it up and send it to the calling officials and say, hey, take a look at this. And if we've missed it or there's an interpretation, we use that as a teaching learning experience. We call it a teachable moment. And so we're all the time trying to evaluate, observe, train, and use those experiences, as we've referenced before, that to try to get better.
All right, so I got to ask you, Justice Winslow, second Duke Carolina game. Was that a charge or what? I mean, verticality. What's going on here? Which was it?
The funny thing is,
settle a bet.
I'm on the National Basketball Rules Committee, and that play was shown over and over and over in our committee. And I had three of the NCAA leaders nationally there, and of course we had our 11-person committee. And if it was an even number, I think it would have been an even split. If it was an odd number, that's the only way somebody would have won the bet or not. The situation in that play was, obviously, verticality, but also because we have initial guarding position. And if we're legal in initial guarding position, do we have to maintain that or can we give on that? And the question on that is, did the lean back call some of the other contact? And it's not settled yet. So that was a great way of dodging the answer to that question. I'm not going to talk about
that's
my colleagues.
But that's the point. I mean, these things do. I mean, you know, did he go straight up or did he lean back? Was it a charge? Is my shoulder forward? These are the things. And the game is in progress. So there's no stop action in the way you look at it. So it's great. And it's exquisite that it would happen in a Duke Carolina game, of course.
And you know, the beauty of that play is there are some folks who are adamant that it was the right call. And there are some folks who are just as adamant that there's no way that can be a block because he had initial legal guarding position.
Well, actually, and you've got three ways. It could have gone – I won't get too detailed here for those of you who didn't see it and care less about basketball. But the fact is you could have called it against the offense, you could have called it against the defense, or you could have not called anything in all three of those possibilities. No call for the offense, for the defense. All three are plausible in that case, right?
Not every contact is a whistle in basketball. That's one that had enough contact. It probably deserved a whistle one way or another. I think if we hadn't – there are some times where bodies will crash and bodies will go flying on the floor and people are just, you know, how is that not a foul? Well, you've got equal opportunity and you've got no possession opportunities and you can have some collisions out there that might not be a foul.
Well, I guess for a ref, you have to look at how it happened, not how it ended.
You have to see where the defense is, where the offense started, and then watch the continuum of the play, and then after that, try to make a judgment call.
How much is it in your head that is a Duke Carolina? I mean, you can't not know it's a big game, right, as a ref?
Well, and this is ideal, but for the good official, they're all good games. And that's what you have to – that's how you have to approach it. If not, you're not going to give your best effort. But sometimes having that really big game, that's the hardest one to have because there's so many other things involved in terms of national TV exposure, ESPN. I have one of my favorite officials I ever called with, and we have – you know, hour-long pregames as officials to get ready for games. And one of his things that he always ended the pregame is he said, hey – we do not want to be on ESPN highlights tonight. I thought it was a great way to enter the floor. It was great.
If you're the official, we do not want to. Let's get back to high school sports and your activity there. You recently spearheaded a mandatory break from the game for football players who lose their helmet. Tell us about that.
It was an observation and also an education. It's pretty neat. Obviously, with all of the head trauma issues and concussion management, that a lot of national attention, dutifully and rightfully. And as I'm observing games, not only watching college games on TV and high school games, I watched how easily our young people were taking their helmets off. I mean, sometimes they weren't even taking a chin strap. They're just pulling them over. And in the education aspect of it, proper fitting of helmets was one of the main variables or criteria in terms of potential head trauma. And so if the helmet was coming off that easily, it was common sense to know that it wasn't fitted properly. And so we weren't taking enough care and concern. So what we did, Arizona worked with us, and we started charting the number of times that helmets came off in a game. And also we charted multiple times for same players. The statistics were great. Right. If you're in the analytics, and I can get into those sometimes, it was really neat. And so we presented that data nationally, and I'm happy to say that North Carolina was the national model, because the National Federation is a rules writing editor for all high school sports. They did implement the rule that if your helmet comes off during a live ball play, that you are mandated to sit out the next play. With that rule that we passed, the NCAA, who sits on our committee, they passed the same rule. And if you watch football games now, the helmets don't come off.
Yeah.
And so we identified an area of need. We identified an area of safety and welfare. And I'm very proud of the fact that we were not only a proponent behind it, but we were the initiator in creating a national standard.
Now, the other concern around high school sports, and particularly football, I think, is the way kids are beefing up to make the team, again, with this aspiration of going further. And it's in many cases unhealthy. We've seen a spotlight shined on whether or not this attention to especially large football players, linemen, that sort of thing, is leading to unhealthy kids.
One of the National Federation does a great job with coaches' education, and they have a lot of elective courses. Some of these are free, about nutrition, hydration, heat exhaustion, and you know, concussion in sports. And we ask our coaches to take those. We're trying to get our coaches. There's an AIC, an accredited interscholastic coach, and a CIC, a certified interscholastic coach. And those are national certifications, like getting your graduate degree, your master's degree, and then your doctorate mm-hmm. degree. And I am very, very proud to say that North Carolina is seventh in the nation in AICs, but we are number one in the nation in the number of coaches who are CICs, which is the top coaching certification you have. So our coaches are getting that, and education is a big part of trying to prevent that. So, you know, we look at hydration. We look at the heat temperature of our practices and what we do. We look at the number of hours that we're practicing. We're looking at the number of contact hours. Mm-hmm. We've just put a new regulation in for football that once we have the first game, that there can be no more than, I think it's 60 minutes of contact, or it's either 60 minutes or 90 minutes of contact throughout the week. So
that's all what happens when you get the kid. But some of those kids are coming to you because they think, or their parents, or who's ever pushing them, that the bigger I get, the better my chances. And that's outside the rules and outside your scope, it seems to me. I'm just wondering if that's a concern for you.
It is, but again, it's got to be an education. You know, if the parent is doing that, they're not educated on the potential harmful side effects. Inclusive of supplements, inclusive of steroids. I do a lot of steroids presentations. You know, they work. We can't say they don't work, because they do. But if you take them without them being prescribed, they are illegal. And so we talk about not the advantages, but we talk about the health risk of steroids. And we cannot be – we can't be I'll use the term again, misplaced. As a parent, I don't want to be so overzealous for my son or my daughter that I'm putting them in potential harm's way to chase that carrot that's in front. We got to do it. It's about nutrition. It's about balance. It's about exercise. It's about effective weight training. and doing it the right way. We got to build it within the developmental structure of our growth plates and how we normally develop physically.
Whose job is it to do that teaching? I can imagine one coach saying, I'm not going to tell my kids to skinny down because it's better for them. The guy, all my competitors aren't. Whose job is it to do that education?
It's all of our responsibilities, from the administrator, setting the proper tone, and I'm talking the school administration. Then it's the athletics administrator to make sure that the coaches she or he hires are going to meet the educational mission of the institution. It's about the coaches understanding that this is education-based athletics, that there is life and the positive outcomes of that should be a natural byproduct, and that our goal should be to train people to be productive citizens, and their legacy ought to be the impact that they can make on people's lives, not winning games.
Mark, what a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Mark Dreibelbiss is the Associate Commissioner of the North Carolina High School Athletic Association. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tai, the intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.